B. Collins. Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, September 4th, 2019. China has created a new gulag. They are locking up Uyghurs. These are a Muslim minority. And as many as a million or more have been subject to re-education camps. But according to Sunday's New York Times, this has now devolved into a massive imprisonment of minority Uyghurs who have been railroaded into prison in record numbers in a process that cannot be called justice. And I commend the Times for drawing attention to this. It should have been a front page story. But they did provide important information. The Chinese government has built a vast network of re-education camps and a pervasive system of surveillance to monitor and subdue millions of Muslim minorities in the Xinjiang region. And now China is filling prisons in Xinjiang. The region has experienced a record surge in arrests, trials, and prison sentences over the past 2 years. The government's policy is described as a strike hard security campaign aimed at overwhelming minorities in Xinjiang and the majority Han Chinese population is largely just observing this whole movement. Now, in the recent years, 2017 and 2018, more than 230,000 people have been sentenced to prison. And for example, last year, courts in that region heard 74,000 cases and only 22 people were found not guilty. Once sentenced, prisoners face potential abuses, hard labor in overcrowded and isolated facilities. Now, this is a crime against humanity. And the Trump administration doesn't care about human rights. And they've been more focused on trying to win a trade war with China. But occasionally in recent weeks, Mike Pompeo has sent signals, I think as part of the trade battle, not a human rights issue, criticizing or with veiled criticism of the Beijing government for its treatment of the Uyghurs. And as I look around the globe, the most persecuted populations are the Palestinians, the Rohingya, and the Uyghurs. Now, there may be others. I don't pretend to be an expert on persecuted populations. But these are the ones who are best known to me. And the human rights mechanisms that were set up, the United Nations, they seem to be largely ineffective in confronting this problem and trying different ways of forcing the Chinese Communist government to change these policies. We also learned over the weekend that the World Bank has loaned millions of dollars to China, and that out of a $1 billion loan amount that was lent to China in calendar 2018, about $50 million of it is believed to being spent on the re-education camps. Questions about the project emerged last week after Senator Marco Rubio of Florida and Representative Jim McGovern of Massachusetts, a Democrat, released a letter outlining concerns about the loan. Now, I certainly think it's worthwhile to protest the loan. But hey, $50 million is not a big deal in the scheme of things. The issue is the policies that are being used and expanded by the Chinese government. And then there's the role of Twitter, based right here in good old San Francisco, where once upon a time, Nancy Pelosi used to stage an annual fight for human rights in China, opposing Bill Clinton's renewal of most favored nation status. But she, too, to my knowledge, has made no comment about the, I guess you can call it ethnic cleansing of the Uyghur population in Xinjiang. So according to an article at The Intercept, and this was published on August 19th under the byline of Ryan Gallagher, Twitter helped promote Chinese government propaganda and disinformation about the internment camps in Xinjiang. The social media company has now announced a change of policy that would bar such promotion following The Intercept's exposure. They found Twitter ads from between June and August of this year showing that the social media giant promoted more than 50 English-language tweets from the Global Times, which is a Chinese state media organization. Several of the tweets deliberately obscure the truth about the situation in Xinjiang and attack critics of the country's Communist Party ruling regime. The Global Times paid Twitter to promote its tweets to a portion of the more than 300 million active users on the platform, and that means it showed up in my timeline even though I've never asked to follow the Global Times Twitter account. I can't say that I saw it, but it could have been in my timeline. It was in the timelines of 300 million people. So, for example, one of them included a video in which the editor-in-chief of the Global Times claimed that people who refer to the facilities in Xinjiang as mass detention camps have smeared the vocational education and training centers established to help people avoid extremism. He went on to attack European politicians and media workers who he claimed had tried to defend terrorist activities in Xinjiang, adding their hands are in a way soiled with the blood of the Chinese people who died in violent attacks. That's quite Orwellian. To first argue that these are simply vocational education and training centers to help people avoid extremism, and then, of course, blaming the entire population for alleged terrorist activities. Also, the Global Times, promoted by Twitter, present the region as a happy, peaceful place where no human rights abuses have occurred. And over at Amnesty International, Patrick Poon, the China researcher, called the ads and the promotion of them by Twitter appalling. This is a very important, serious issue that Twitter needs to address. Twitter is helping to promote false allegations and government propaganda. Allowing such advertising sets an alarming precedent. And as you know, I've launched this campaign, have this fresh podcast posted yesterday at Who, What, Why, a conversation with Russ Baker of Who, What, Why, and Mark Carlin of BuzzFlash, about Twitter's failure to apply its own standards and enforce them against a guy named Donald J. Trump. And last week, you may know that Brett Stevens, a columnist at the New York Times, who is relentless in skewering the critics of Israel, couldn't take it when a professor of media and public affairs at George Washington University, David Karpf, made fun of Stevens. And he called him a bedbug, all right? Now, I'm a little lost in this because according to this account that I'm reading from The Guardian, there were accusations that the newsroom of the New York Times was infested with bedbugs. And I thought it was actually the Trump Doral Resort in Miami where bedbugs, I know I can say it, have actually been discovered. And so I can't account for the bedbug epithet. But Brett Stevens wrote to the boss at George Washington University, Professor Karp, and he said, "I'm often amazed about the things supposedly decent people are prepared to say about other people on Twitter. I think you've set a new standard. I would welcome the opportunity for you to come to my home, meet my wife and kids, talk to us for a few minutes, and then call me a bedbug to my face." Oh, boy. Brett Stevens has deleted his Twitter account to relief all around. Hey, here's relief from Italy. This story just broke before I sat down here behind the microphone today. Matteo Salvini, the monster who has been the interior secretary or whatever they run. He ran the interior ministry. He has been sacked in the reorganization of the government and replaced by a pro-migration civil servant and specialist in migration policy, Luciana Lamorgese, a 38-year veteran of the Interior Ministry. Could you take Stephen Miller with you, Mr. Salvini? New York Times on Sunday had a front-page story that went on and on and on, and I can summarize it for you in a few seconds here. Part of the Trump tax plan of 2017 included the creation of so-called enterprise zones. These are, you know, basically abandoned areas on the urban hardscape. And they set up tax incentives to drive investment in these designated zones. And look who's taking advantage of it. Billionaire financiers Leon Cooperman and Sidney Cole. The fat boy former governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie. Richard LaFrack, a New York real estate titan close to Trump. Anthony Scaramucci, yes, the guy who got bounced from Twitter for 12 hours because he said that Trump was fat. He probably meant he's lined me up for fat profits. Oh, and the Kushner family. Yes, they are cashing in and profiteering on this opportunity created by Donald Trump and the Republicans. So tonight on CNN, in order to comply with the commands of the Democratic National Committee, which forbade the hosting of a debate of the presidential candidates focused solely on climate change. So what we get is serial mini town halls. There are going to be 10 of them. And I fired up my DVR this morning and I had to set it 10 times. To record each of the candidates. Now, I plan to fast forward through most of it, but I will say that it's better than nothing. But I would rather see these candidates interact, compare their plans, argue it out. And instead, you're going to get a series of monologues, well, mostly a monologue with some interruption or prodding from a CNN anchor. And so I don't think this is going to be very satisfying. I don't know how many of you plan to spend 7 hours watching all 10 of the leading candidates of the Democratic gaggle. But over at BuzzFeed, they thumbnailed it for us, and I think this is fairly accurate. These are predictions. Biden will home in on his foreign affairs experience, talk up his plan for how the U.S. could lead the world on climate action. Andrew Yang will elaborate on his unique support for geoengineering. Yeah, chemtrails to fix climate change? Cory Booker, Julian Castro, and Kamala Harris will jostle to be the environmental justice champion. Elizabeth Warren will dive into her detailed plan on how the military can respond to the climate emergency. I'm real dubious about that one. Castro will expand on his call for a new category of refugees called climate refugees. Buttigieg and Klobuchar pitch themselves as the middle American candidates with climate plans to boost agriculture. And Sanders will come out against carbon capture. Now, I haven't heard that attributed to Bernie Sanders before, and I'm not sure what his objections are. Much of the effort to capture carbon is theoretical. So I will watch and listen and see if Bernie covers that particular issue. Meanwhile, the Democrats are going back and forth over how the caucuses, limited now to Iowa and Nevada, coming up in early 2020, will handle voters who don't come physically, personally, to the caucus. Now, there was this idea for virtual caucuses where people could vote by phone. And this has been shot down. And listener Susan Pennington reminded me that Brad Friedman of bradblog.com is quite opposed to voting by phone. My interest in the virtual caucuses was they had threatened to try out ranked choice voting. And I think in this heavily populated primary, that ranked choice made a lot of sense. The coverage doesn't indicate whether that is still in play or not. And I recognize the risks of using phones for people to vote. But we're doing so much absentee ballot voting by mail already, which I consider to be quite vulnerable. And I think at minimum, vote-by-mail systems could be set up to expand participation in these caucuses. And I do agree that, you know, Brad, I'd love to see elections that are only conducted in ways that we find have high integrity. But it appears the Democrats have only discovered election integrity as a concept in recent weeks, as they argue over the rules about the caucuses. And I want to thank John Zwiebel, who sent me this remarkable op-ed written by Obama's former chief of staff, Dennis McDonough. And he takes us all back to Russiagate. And those dastardly Putinites are ready to ruin our election in 2022. That was 2020 also, not the year 2022. He writes, "That's why I support the DNC's decision to reject a virtual caucus plan put forward in Iowa and Nevada. The goal to make caucuses more inclusive and increase participation is laudable. And we should continue to explore options that ensure and expand the most fundamental constitutional right, the right to vote. However, the virtual caucus proposal comes with serious cybersecurity risks. Security experts agree that the technology as it exists now is too vulnerable and could easily fall victim to hacking by outside actors, including Russia." Now, the reason I am laughing is not that I, you know, poo-poo cybersecurity of any kind. But the Democrats, since 2000, since Bush stole it from Gore, and then Bush stole it from Kerry, and then Trump stole it from Hillary, they haven't lifted a finger to address the problem with the simple and beautiful solution of hand-counted paper ballots, hand-counted at the precinct. And that's what we should be talking about. I was a little surprised to see Richard Cohen's op-ed the other day in the Washington Post. Headlined, "It's Time to Bid Farewell to Joe Biden." And Cohen says he says it with regret, because Joe is the nicest of fellows, lacking malice, who likes people and likes doing something for them. Yet his gaffes continue feeding the impression that he is a touch gaga. Is he Lord Gaga? And worse, no one can complete the sentence, "Joe Biden, because." So Cohen makes it clear he supports Elizabeth Warren, who he refers to as a good ideologue, and then Bernie Sanders, who he calls a bad ideologue. But his bottom line is that Biden will stumble, fumble, and gaffe himself through a campaign that will make him lose. On his own, I'm quoting, "He is a geyser of flubs, of almost happenings. He has recently mistaken New Hampshire for Vermont. He recounted a moving visit to the White House by the kids at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School when he was VP. But at the time of the shootings, the VP was, of course, Mike Pence. Biden gets so much wrong. But as always, his heart is in the right place." Well, I think he has shown himself to be a very weak candidate, and it's time for the Democrats to recognize that. He has a lot of loyal supporters who are blind to the facts, and it won't be easy, but I think that the polls are going to make the decision for Joe Biden in the very near future. Every day I pause for a moment to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Brian Carey, Terry Paris, Don Cisney, and the fine folks at DGL Engraving. Kick in $5 or $10 a month. You could do it too, and that's why I mention them. It's my low-key, guilt-free approach to trolling for new subscribers. All you have to do is visit peterbcollins.com, find menu, click on Become a Subscriber, you hit the sign-up page, easy to choose, $5, $10, $20 a month, $50 annual subscription gets you a bonus book offer. Bonus books currently 2100, Dystopian Utopia, and Dr. Justin A. Frank's casual analysis of Donald Trump, Trump on the Couch. Remember the name Jeremy Hammond? He's serving a 10-year sentence for being convicted of computer hacking. His sentence came with immunity from prosecution in other jurisdictions. And what he was convicted of stealing millions of internal emails from the intelligence firm Stratfor and handing them off to WikiLeaks back in February of 2012. The hack also exposed tens of thousands of credit card numbers for Stratfor clients. So, that's why Jeremy Hammond is currently in federal prison. But he was moved from Memphis, where he is serving his sentence, to the suburbs of Washington, D.C. and Virginia, where he is expecting to testify before the grand jury that he believes is the WikiLeaks grand jury. Now, I opened this particular story by referencing that his sentence included immunity from prosecution in other districts. Apparently, that does not prevent them from demanding that he testify before a grand jury. Or they are just willfully breaking the rules and the law. Well, I hope that Hammond will take a cue from Chelsea Manning and refuse to testify. Over at the Trump White House, we've revealed this new plan to attack journalists who are seen as critics or enemies of the White House or even enemies of the people. Now we're told that they've raised $2 million, or at least they're trying to. They're circulating a fundraising pitch. And to retaliate against those who dare to offer critical coverage of this administration, they will slip damaging information about reporters and editors to friendly media outlets like Breitbart, and traditional media like Fox. And people include GOP consultant Arthur Schwartz, and a loose network that the New York Times reported on last week that is targeting journalists. Over in Britain, the Boris Brexit Johnson imbroglio continues, and it is a little hard to follow. I want to credit Rachel Maddow for giving us 4 minutes of the back-and-forth debate in the raucous Parliament yesterday in the House of Commons. But from what we can put together, Boris Johnson will be calling a snap election if he can get the approval of the minority Labour Party. Now, it's only barely a minority because Boris Johnson and the Conservatives no longer have a majority. As of last night, he had lost control of Parliament, and he has fractured his Conservative Party by purging 21 rebel Tory lawmakers who voted against him. And he wants an election about October 15th, but the Labour folks and their leader, Jeremy Corbyn, who is either sly like a fox or I'm not sure, because I heard a quote from Corbyn where he basically is saying he doesn't oppose Brexit, he just opposes a no-deal Brexit. And maybe that is what they believe is the state of play now, and it's simply a matter that Brexit will occur, and they're trying to determine the manner in which that rolls out. But now the question is whether to allow an election to take place in October or delay it into November once the current Brexit deadline has been put back beyond October 31st. So we will continue to watch this. It's fascinating. Sometimes we need a little translation. And over at The Guardian today, they had some helpful explainers. Because one of the things that occurred when they punished the Conservatives who didn't vote with Johnson yesterday, it's called withdrawing the whip. An MP who has the whip withdrawn sits as an independent, but can be brought back into the party fold if it decides to restore the whip. Having the whip withdrawn is one of the most serious disciplinary actions that can be taken against a member of parliament by a party. In this case, it may mean that they're barred from standing for the Tories in the next election. And asking and answering the question, what happens next? Johnson has said that even if the rebels' vote passes, he will never request an extension beyond October 31st from the EU, and the people of this country will have to choose in an election. However, he needs a two-thirds majority to secure an early general election, which means that Labour can block it. Which means, if somebody says they know what's going on, don't believe them. The United Nations has issued a report on human rights violations in the war in Yemen. And there's little doubt that Saudi Arabia would be accused of potential war crimes or actual war crimes, such as arbitrary killings, starving a population, torture, and other abuses. But they also say that by arming and backing the Saudi-led so-called coalition, the United States, Britain, and France may be complicit in potential war crimes as well. The UN report also challenges the credibility of the Saudi-led coalition to self-investigate and hold itself accountable for attacks that kill civilians. That assurance, routinely given by the Saudis after every attack, is often cited by Trump administration and British officials to justify, or shall we say rationalize, continued military support and arms sales to that coalition. In Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, the leader there, has finally done what she should have done at the beginning of the protest months ago. She has formally withdrawn the contentious extradition bill that was the trigger. And it appears now that that is too little too late. But it also appears to be a concession that may be followed by a hardline crackdown. Beijing's leader Xi Jinping, in a speech Tuesday, called on rising party officials to show resolve for the long struggle, but suggested that the leadership could adjust its tactics to achieve its aims. Quote, "On matters of principle, not an inch will be yielded, but on matters of tactics, there can be flexibility." We shall see. Here in California, for several months, over in Sacramento in the legislature, they've been wrangling over a bill to treat Uber, Lyft, and other so-called gig workers as employees and not independent contractors. It relates to your right to have unemployment, workers' comp, health benefits, vacation, those sorts of things. And Governor Gavin Newsom, who my biggest criticism of him is he's often a little too corporate. Well, he has surprised me and come out strongly in favor of AB 5. On Labor Day, he said employers shirk responsibility to safety net programs like workers' comp and unemployment. Taxpayers are left to foot the bill. Reversing the trend of misclassification is a necessary and important step to improve the lives of working people. That's why this Labor Day I'm proud to support Assembly Bill 5, which extends critical labor protections to more workers by curbing misclassification. So, what has surfaced here in the final days? The legislature will adjourn a week from Friday. Is that the newspaper publishers want a carve out for the people who are most exploited in the media industry? That is, the people who deliver newspapers to my home. Now, they used to be employees of the paper, and many of them were union members. But now they're subcontractors who often deliver for more than one newspaper. And in a really gut-wrenching appeal, the publishers have been pushing for an exemption of their own. And I've mentioned that my friend Steve Horn, who writes about various issues now from San Diego, he's raised concerns about how AB 5 would affect freelance reporters who want to be freelance or who aren't offered work if it's not freelance because there aren't any full-time jobs available at most media outlets these days. So I'm pleased to see Governor Newsom support it. And here's one that is going to get a lot of attention, a lot of negative commentary. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors passed a resolution yesterday declaring the National Rifle Association a domestic terrorist organization and urging the city to examine its financial relationships with companies that do business with the group. On the heels of the Gilroy, California shooting in July, the supervisors decided unanimously to adopt this measure. Quote, "The NRA musters its considerable wealth and organizational strength to promote gun ownership and incite gun owners to acts of violence. The NRA spreads propaganda that misinforms and aims to deceive the public about the dangers of gun violence. And the leadership of the National Rifle Association promotes extremist positions in defiance of the views of majority of its membership and the public and undermine the general welfare. I think it's accurate. I'm not sure it will be helpful in whatever passes for debate about gun laws in the next few months. And finally today, I want to recommend a piece by Brian Sonnenstein. He writes about prisons over at Shadowproof, and he notes that at the prison in Soledad, that's in Monterey County, south of San Jose, about an hour, they got a visit from Ralph Diaz, who is the new secretary of the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. He took a really strong, firm position that he did not want to segregate populations of the prison when they went out in the yard, the recreation yard. And prisoners say that he was adamant that the groups must share the yard, and if they can't get along, they'll have to live with the violence. The very next day, the populations were blended or mixed, and a very nasty fight broke out. Now, beyond the impact of the incident and people who get injured or maybe even die, nobody did in this incident, the impact is on prisoners who end up being punished or losing parole rights, being downed by the parole board because they participated in a fight at a prison. And while I'm uncomfortable with segregating prisoners by race, there's no question that maintaining security and safety for all in a prison sometimes requires those difficult kinds of decisions to separate people. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. Feel free to share it everywhere. You'll find it on YouTube. And I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.